You're listening to Face Off, episode 97, recorded November 29th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I am Mark Sanborn.
This is, I was just thinking about this, your face-to-face web technology, you getting two faces for the price of one. That's amazing. In this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship, as well as awesome web deals like two faces for the price of one. As always, you can view our show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. The winner's officially here, Mark. I'm going to be honest with you here in snowy Montana. It's ready to go.
Yeah, it's warming up. You know, it's about 20 degrees outside. Warming up, coming from the negatives. It's kind of crazy when you think about, you know, 0 to 20. Yeah. Like, you don't think of it as being a big difference, but that's 20 degrees, and it's a lot colder.
Yeah, it's like the difference between having to wear something over your face because your cheeks might get frostbite versus not having to wear.
I've started prepping, and I've got snow boots now and a few things.
Me too. I bought some big old Baffin snow boots and some turtle fur face protector because it's cold out, and I have to walk to the bus and stuff. As such, it's getting dry out, so I have to whip out the old Chapsticko. I am a classic Chapstick guy, Chapstick brand. You use some crazy stuff, don't you? It's like some Japanese stuff. You get it imported from Nagasaki.
Well, I used to date a Japanese girl, and she had given me one of hers one time. This is like the cheap, this is like the Chapstick of Japan is like $1 for like two sticks to last you like 6 months or something. But
what is it?
I don't know.
What's
I just
the brand?
Worked, and she sent me like a case of it one time.
No way.
Awesome. And so, but I'm about to run out, so I'm probably going to switch to like Burt's Bees or something.
Oh, no. You're not going to go scour the internet for
like the best Chapstick in the world?
This was blessed by a monk in the lower. No.
I'll probably just, I don't know. Who knows?
Whatever. All right. Well, let's move on to other cool stuff. Our geek tool of the week is a Bedal water-powered clock. I thought this is pretty cool. We tried to look it up, and you found one sort of water-powered clock, but these ones don't mention that. I think these are like powered by water, actually. I think it's not in the way the ones you found. Anyways, the Bedal water-powered clock is only $16.85 on Amazon. You fill it with water, and the clock runs until the water runs out, apparently, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, so I started looking into how these things work, and I saw like the old ancient ones where it's like gravity and the water flows from one area to another and then to another. And this is obviously not that.
Hey, salt. So then that's what it is. Ha.
Salt?
It says a dash of salt in with the water will keep. So it is just like you found.
So what I found is, they were talking about like you have to put a little splash of lemon juice in there. I was like, man, if I had to go buy lemon juice for this thing, it's not cool. Not as cool. It's still cool that it's powered by just the water.
They also,
The description of this, it said only tap water is necessary. They didn't say anything about lemon juice. So I think tap water usually has a decent amount of salt in it.
Right. This is similar to making a clock out of like a potato battery or a lemon battery, right? I mean, we did like little experiments like this in elementary school.
With like a little Christmas light or something powered by lemon juice.
Yeah, exactly. So also, yeah, I was looking at this. It requires a splash of water and a dash of salt, but they also recommend you cut a lemon in half and squeeze some lemon juice in the water tank just in case. So it is. It's just basically making a battery using two metal rods. It's really, the water is not powering it. The water just sort of makes an electrical connection for you. Anyway,
but I think it's an interesting idea, and it's kind of a novelty thing to have in the office.
Yeah, exactly. Or, and you could tell people, you know, when they say, they're like, oh, the, you know, you're like, well, guess what? You don't want to know. You want to know how eco-friendly I am. I don't use electricity for my clock. I use freaking water.
Yeah,
I'm so, about it, clocks I'm so really green don't, it hurts.
Clocks don't really use much battery electricity.
Hey, shh.
Which makes this work. I mean, it's a perfect application yeah. to have a lemon juice powered device.
You would. You always got to rain on my parade. Check it out. The Badal powered. Actually, and we picked the one. I picked the style that I thought was sort of the nicest. There's different styles, but this one I thought was sort of a nice, classy little sort of bulb design. You could even, you know, they have one on ThinkGeek too where you can, it has like a little hole in the back where the water pokes out where you can put like flowers in or something and use it as a vase while it's powering your clock. Check it out, the Badal, or Badal, I don't know how to pronounce that, water-powered clock. Only $16.85 at Amazon, worth every penny. Let's move on to our web apps. Our first web app is called Scrim. It's at scr.im. And this is actually a question I get a lot from people I've seen where I work. They say, hey, I want you to put my email on my website, but I don't want the spammers to scrape it because they'll scrape it and they'll start sending emails. The funny part is I don't run into this because, to be honest with you, I use Gmail, who has amazing spam filtering. So this, you know, I hardly ever get spam. A lot of people out there who aren't, and they want to be able to put their website out there without getting bombarded with spam. And that's what Scrim does, actually, is it gives you, you put in your email address and that'll give you a Scrim URL. So I'm like scr.im/JadeRobbins. But what that does is it gives you a sort of HTML code to put your email address, and it only shows part of the letters. It doesn't show all the letters. And what you do is you click on that link, and when you click on that link, it makes sure that you're not a robot by doing a CAPTCHA-like test. It shows like some text that looks like CAPTCHA and then asks you to click which one is the same letters. And then when you do that, it will actually display the email address. So make sure you're a human. You are a human to retrieve that email. And when you go there, you can click on the link to email them, or they even have a click to compose in Gmail link, which is totally cool because the mail too doesn't always work in Gmail.
Yeah, and when they even have, so you can copy. It's all in all, it's just like a URL type shortener, kind of is how it's ran. Mm-hmm. But I like how you could copy and paste, and it'll actually make a link with parts of your email address missing. Like right. dots or stars at, and then like gmail.com, or they'll even right. blank that out. And then if you click on it, then like you said, you go through a CAPTCHA and then you get to actually email the person or copy and paste it and email them or email direct from mm-hmm. Gmail.
Yeah. So this was a question I got a lot. There was like, there's some goofy tricks people use where like they basically HTML encode the email, and that really only stops the most basic spammers. Any smart person can run. I mean, there's like a Ruby function. There's a PHP function to take HTML characters and decode them. It's not hard. So that really only stops the most basic scrapers. This really makes sure that you're a human. So unless the human is physically going around clicking email addresses and collecting them, you're pretty safe. The only complaint I do have is it is kind of confusing. Like if you went to a website and saw this link with like half an email address with a couple sparse letters, you'd be like, what is that? You know, so you make sure you use the link carefully. Like maybe you could change it instead of to like the missing letters, like click here to get my email address or something. And then just make sure you're human, and it's solved. Hey, Mark, guess what? So actually what I wanted to ask you was, did you have a nice Thanksgiving?
I did. I ate a lot of food and had, you know, the usual turkey stuffing, cranberry,
me too.
Jello stuff.
My mom made my favorite cake in the whole world. It's this delicious sort of black angel food cake with this butter rum sauce. So good. But I guess, tangent, what I'm getting to is now that Thanksgiving is over, today is actually Cyber Monday, we are officially diving headfirst into Christmas season. And I know, like for me, it's sometimes like, you know, the holiday isn't about presents and stuff. But one thing you always hear from your family is, what do you want for Christmas, Marky? What is Grandma going to get you for Christmas? And that's, you know... for years I've done an Amazon wish list, but there's a problem with that. Amazon has a lot of stuff, but they don't have everything. Like I like a lot of stuff on ThinkGeek. I like a lot of stuff on, you know, there's just on their own product page. So we talked about one of these before called Wishpod. I can't remember in which episode we did, but Wishpod is basically, these are applications that allow you to do a wish list no matter what service. So if you have something on Amazon or something on ThinkGeek, it doesn't matter. This, with our web app this time, is called Wishlister, which is wishlister.com. And what it does is it's dead simple wish list. If you want, you know, you sign in, you wishlister.com/Jade Robbins to view my list. You can create multiple wish lists. But really what you do is once you make a wish list, it can even import your Amazon wish list for you or your Delicious links if you keep a bunch of stuff in your Delicious links. And then it's just a really dead simple wish list that you can add any item from any website you want, really simple. And then you can point your family there, say, Grandma, go to wishlister.com/Mark Sanborn and buy me something there. Because this happens to me all the time. My mom goes, what do you want for Christmas? And I'm like, I don't know. I can't remember. You can't put me on the spot like that. I can't remember that stuff.
Yeah. You pretty much summed it up. It's your basic wish list. You add stuff to it. I really liked it. I mean, we've talked about these before on Face Off Show. I think we covered Wishpod a long time ago.
We did cover Wishpod, but it was like, Wishpod's a pretty full featured app, which if you really are into your wish list, like, you know, let's say you're doing like a wedding registry or a baby wish list. What do you call them? Baby registry? Anyway, so one of those you're putting a lot of time into. I just like a dead simple list, you know. So this is like a really easy way for me to get an easy, quick wish list up, you know. Like I might keep one that's like under $10 and then one above, you know. So it's like if you want just a quick one to go to the $10 one. But really simple wish list. You can add an item to anywhere.
If your friends and family are tech savvy, they can even subscribe via RSS and see new stuff that you add.
That's crazy.
It's that
talk.
Times.
That's
that
crazy.
Is crazy. That's some terrible. Hardcore stuff. What I'm going to do this Christmas, I think, is fill this out and pass it around to my family and friends.
There
and,
you go. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Friends, are we obligated to buy gifts? Oh God, I don't have a gift for you. I'm so embarrassed. Check it out, wishlister.com. Hey, you listening to the show? I'm talking about. You, if you have some news and follow-up, a web app, a geek tool, I want you to let us know our topic idea. Go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can tweet us out, send us an email. We'd love to hear your ideas or your suggestions. Let us know. We appreciate it. And let's get into our topic this week, which is a topic near and very dear to my heart, which is server administration for web developers.
So normally on Face Off Show, we try to cover web dev, web technology type stuff, and we try to keep OS specific things out of the podcast as we try to just focus on the web technology side of things. However, it seems apparent to me that, you know, especially with smaller sites and smaller apps and maybe getting started developing and even developing itself, you need a web server. it's definitely not good to be doing your development on a live server, so it's good to make your own development server.
Why is that? I develop all the time on live servers. What are you talking about?
Well, if you develop on a live server, you have the potential for taking the site down you could accidentally drop the database, the whole thing. I mean, yeah. You could, you know, users could see interruptions and
I mean, you usually have active users. You usually are connected to your production database. So just in general, it's not a good practice to develop on a production box.
I got away with it for years back in the day when I didn't know any better, but yeah, it's definitely not best practices. We're going to talk about it just because with our apps that we do and the sites that I run, I find myself doing a lot of different server administration stuff, even though I'm not like that. That's not what I'm not a full-time server admin type guy, but you know, you should know the basics if you're going to run a server,
right?
You know, web app.
I mean, there's some really basic hosting out there. You know, like a lot of the really simple, dead simple web hosting is just upload your website. You never know. You're not doing any of this. You're just FTPing your stuff up. You know, maybe if you're doing PHP, it'll run your PHP automatically for you. You know, but there is, you know, even you could even use something like Dreamhost without any of these tools. But once you start, you know, you get to that next level where you really really understand the system that you're developing in, you really understand what's going on, you're going to want to basically get into the console. You're going to want to fire up a terminal, and you're going to have to, or you're either going to need to because your app will be too advanced to just put on basic hosting anymore, or you're going to want to take it to that next level and really do these things yourself. And that's where that's what this episode is aimed at, is for those people that are just really like starting to do their own system administration. You know, I did basic GoDaddy hosting, or I did a Squarespace site for the longest time, but then I did learn a little PHP, a little HTML, a little CSS, and I want to, you know, I got, you know, a DreamHost account, which gives me shell access. It gives me just basic FTP access too. But, you know, I want to take it to the next level. This is where you start. This is kind of your crash course in beginning system administration.
Very well said. If you are the guy that's doing FTP up to launch your site, still pay attention, just because you're probably going to be wanting to run your PHP on maybe LAMP MAMP or WAMP types, or which is just, you know, PHP and Apache running on Windows or Mac.
Right. You don't administer just production environments too. I mean, you know, your development environment is, you know, especially this is definitely going to be more focused at, you know, Linux, Unix, Mac OS is pretty relevant here. But, most web servers and web developers I know are developing stuff that runs on Linux, Unix. an accurate statement, but or I don't know if it's accurate that everyone is, but it seems to me that what I see from most people, at least in the communities that I run in, is that it's Linux, Unix.
Yep. So let's get into the first thing, SSH. We've talked about SSH before. It's the basic protocol you use to log into a remote server securely. The first thing you want to do is kind of learn a little bit about, it's usually the first thing that you install if you're, you know, starting a server from scratch.
Right.
If you're using something like DreamHost, this is usually provided for you.
Right.
Smaller host, or, you know, the more basic type hosting like GoDaddy, they might not give you SSH access.
A lot of shared hosting doesn't let you, just because it does open the potential for... It's just more risky in general for everyone, unless you really know what you're doing. Like I found, I think DreamHost is pretty smart and secure about how they secure their system. So that's why they're very open with shell access. Plus they realize, you know, once you reach a certain level of web development, it's almost impossible to do it without shell access anymore. It gets very frustrating without it.
Mm-hmm. The first thing you want to do is you want to make sure that SSH is secure, because it is often, I mean, it is probably the most widely used remote, you know, remote login software, so it's often the one that's most attacked.
Right.
The first thing you want to do is turn root login off. Usually, what you do is you log in with a normal username and then you sudo to get root privileges, or you switch user to root.
Right.
If you allow root login, the attacker already knows one of the two credentials. They know the username.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because by default, I think most every single, you know, Linux installation has a root user. And so actually, I think you can also disable root login via SSH, but a lot of people just disable root login in general. Because the whole point is, if you need to do anything, you do a sudo, which stands for super user do, or SU, like you're talking about, which is switch user to you switch. Because you could, even if it's disabled, you can still switch user to that account. And that's how you do administration and stuff. But to do that, like a super user, you have to be in the group of people that can sudo, and you also have to re-input your password. So you can't just, you know, if you somehow, like, let's say I walk away from my computer and I'm SSH into my server, and you're like, all right, you know, sudo, you know, rm-rf/, like, which means delete everything on my hard drive. If you don't know my password, you still can't do, you know, a super user command.
Very, very good point. So that is the first security thing to check
and
off.
And also, a lot of this is pretty high-level stuff. We're not high-level, but we're not giving you details. Like, we're not saying go into /etc/ssh/, you know, ssh/conf. We'll give you links to sort of the most common way to do a lot of these, you know, common tasks.
The next one that's good to do is to change the default port. I find that if I started off with just the regular SSH on my, I think it was my router or might have been one of the boxes I was working with, but I don't even know what I was doing. I was probably writing a blog article on how to check logs or something, but I was checking my logs and I found that there was just literally thousands of attempts to log in via SSH on port 22. I was like, whoa, someone's trying to hack in. And I kind of did some research and I found that for, you know, port 22 is just the people scan for it and try to hack it all over the place. If it's a public facing IP and port 22 is open, someone's trying to get in.
Yeah, I mean, they're just basically, they're checking every single IP in the world. They're knocking on port 22. And then if it's open, they just start trying to log in as much as they can. They just start hammering it.
Now, you know, I would suggest changing it to a different, you know, port 22, you know, something that's not being used. Mm-hmm. 22222222. Now, so, you know, hardcore security guys will sometimes say, well, that's not any better. It's, you know, you're just changing the port. You could find it out. Yeah, it's kind of true, but at least it blocks the automated attacks that are just going for port 22.
It lessens the noise. I mean, if someone is really trying to get into your machine, yeah, they can find out that you have that port open somewhere else. But just these sort of automated bots that are just spamming out, looking for the really easy, low-hanging fruit, you know. And then also, I mean, I think it just clears up your log. Your machine's doing less because it's not constantly processing all these login requests. Like, nope, root's disabled. Nope, root's disabled like a million times a second, you know. It's just not worth it.
So consider changing the port. Another thing is to consider changing the key or changing to use a key instead of a password or use a key password combo. Mm-hmm. With SSH, you can have what's called a keyless login where you have a passwordless login where you don't have to type in a password at the terminal. You basically send a small key file with your SSH request and it lets you in that way. It's basically like having a password that's like, I don't know, 128 characters long.
Right.
Whatever the keys are.
And you go onto the remote box and you say, hey, here is the, you know, the public key for my local machine, right, on the other side. And that public key mixed with my machine's private key, which it will send to you when it tries to authenticate, will show you that I am who I am. So if someone goes up and they say, hey, I'm Jade Robbins at this server, wink, wink, you know, and the keys don't match, then, you know, you still can't log in. But convenience from a user standpoint is that I just say SSH that machine. And if I set that up, you know, it just logs me right in. I don't even have to put in my password. And it's just as secure as using a password.
Which is nice, too, if you have some scripts that automatically run at night or whatever. You don't have to put your password in the cron job or a shell script or something. And also, it's worth noting that Amazon, by default, at least the instance that I was running, automatically set the SSH with a key instead of a password. They give that key to you when you start it up. So I thought that was kind of like a good practice.
Right.
In Linux, all the configuration files are edited with you know, a text editor. They're not like GUI-based like Windows sometimes is. And you're usually logged in with SSH, so it's good to know a good terminal-based editor because you're not going to be wanting to like log in with FTP, pull down a text file, change it, save it, then upload it again. You want to just, you know, get into that
file,
change
it. It'll save you a lot of time just to learn how to use a console-based text editor.
Some simple ones. I used Nano for a long time before I figured out how to use Vim. Vim is good. Emacs, they're a little more... They have a learning curve if you've never used one like that before. I think Nano is installed on Debian systems by default.
Nano and Pico are the two ones that you usually can find that are the simplest. I mean, I would suggest in case you are going on some really old systems or super stripped down systems, usually Vi is there, and that's my editor of choice for everything anyways. So I may be biased. I might get into some flame wars here for it, but... I mean, I found that on some super stripped down Linux boxes that you usually can find Vi. I think Pico and Nano are usually some of the newer ones. Vi has been around forever, since like the 70s, I think. So usually the really stripped down version of Vi is at least on there. So it would be good, I would say, to at least get, you know, a handle of how to just make basic edits in Vi.
You know, some of the things we're going to talk about, like php.ini, like all these configurations are going to be done via the console. So learning a good terminal-based editor is good. And sometimes making emergency code edits if you need to put up a maintenance page real quick because the server is getting hammered.
You know it. Yep.
Sometimes some of these things, you know, sometimes you have to make an emergency, you know, whatever, you know, so good to have one of those. And absolutely, good to know how to use it when the time comes.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be fumbling around with some user guide to the text editor that you're going to be using while trying to fix this emergency code edit because your whole website's down. Better to learn it ahead of time, and then you'll be ready when the time comes.
It's good to have a some stats and monitoring tools in your belt. We're going to link to an article that has literally like hundreds of different ways to get these, but the three that I use the most are free-m, which shows the memory usage.
Plays Freebird, right?
Which is, yeah.
Which how is awesome really, would that be?
Which is really useful for, especially with VPSs, when you have very limited RAM. You totally have to really watch. That's probably the one that I watch the most these days.
Yeah, that happened to us with AgileTask, actually. It was I sent a support ticket in, like, a kind of, because I didn't check the RAM because I'm an idiot, and I sent a support ticket in saying my VBS is getting really slow and doing this goofy stuff, and he's like, hey, you're out of memory, so you need to fix that.
Top is a great one. You can get memory stuff, CPU, you can sort by process, which is taking the most CPU and things. It's kind of the general it's kind of like Windows task manager. You see all the processes and you can sort by the most. DF-H will show you your hard drive, all your hard drives and all your mounts that are mounted and how much space they have left. And then DUH will show you each directory.
Yeah. So like if you are like, man, I think my whole hard drive is full, you can use DF-H, and dash H just means make it human readable, because otherwise I think it's in like crazy bytes and stuff. Human readable means like, you know, gigabytes or megabytes and stuff. Yeah, right. Yeah, stuff you'll understand. And DU-H is the same thing, except for like it's, you know, is that like what file in this folder is huge, and then it'll show you all the ones in the folder. And depending upon which OS, sometimes it'll actually recurse into the lower folders and tell you, you know, how much the folders inside that folder are, their size. Which can be time-consuming sometimes when you don't know that and you have a massive directory inside one and you're like, oh, DU-H. And you're like, why is this taking 3 hours?
It's I don't use that one as much anymore just because I'm on like the Elastic Block Store. It just adds gigabytes from the cloud as soon as you start running low.
You but just got gigabytes going everywhere. You're crazy.
Gigabytes going like crazy, but yeah, if you're starting to run out of hard drive space, you're gonna have some trouble. So check that one out. So this is kind of LAMP stack specific. Know how to update your OS. This is really important. If you've got some old version of Apache that's got some security vulnerabilities, you could have your site hacked without having any actual code problems, but have just because your server is out of date. So totally, you're going to want to know how to update your OS. It's probably the first thing you're going to want to do when you get running, and keep it up to date. Maybe once every 2 weeks, once a month, once a day. Figure out something that makes sense for you and make sure you update your OS.
Again, make sure if you have shared hosting, sometimes they should be doing this for you. If you have shared hosting with SSH access. Also, again, I guess I should be careful, is if you're on shared hosting and they give you SSH access, be very careful about doing sudo, because they might get very angry at you for trying to sudo on their servers. That's more for your own local server or your own VPS if you have one.
I'm glad you brought up the shared hosting. I've seen some people that, you know, even if, let's say you don't have control over like updating your PHP version, mm-hmm. Check the versions of the main things you're using, like Apache, yeah, PHP, and maybe check out to see if there's some major security vulnerabilities. I know some shared hosts, the good ones will keep on top of it, and if like, for example, PHP 4 is really insecure, they will switch to PHP 5, but some people are still running old stuff, and it's, I don't know if it's just because the shared host hasn't updated that particular box. But
yeah, that's very well said, actually. They should be, but that doesn't mean they are. So check out how to check your versions and make sure that they're on time, because even shared hosts sometimes slack too. And if not only is your stuff vulnerable, everyone else's or anyone else, it doesn't matter if you wrote secure code. If someone else's stuff is totally vulnerable, if they wrote bad code and it's running an old version of MySQL or Apache or something, they can get root access and wipe all your. I mean, I've been on shared hosting that has been hacked 3 times. Never was it my fault. It was someone else's app and, you know, security vulnerability in the host that caused it to do it. So.
If your app or site needs to send mail, you might want to learn how to set up a simple SMTP server. In my apps lately, I've been just using Google Apps and pointing it to Google. They handle all the email stuff. I just send it to them. But maybe XM postfix or simple SMTP.
Yeah, I don't know. This one always confuses me because I never know which one to set up or how to do it locally. So this is where, again, to be honest with you, most... hopefully with a lot of things you can point it to use someone else's mail server that is better managed, like Google Apps. A lot of my apps now, I really all use like something else that will push to Google Apps so I don't have to manage my own email server, because I'm a firm advocate of not maintaining your own email server. But a lot of times there's system applications that require just some sort of default mail sending server, so you kind of have to set it up, and that sucks. But if you do, you know, we'll link to a guide or a couple guides to make sure that you're doing it right, so that it only allows sending from local things and you're not a big spam bot for everyone else on the internet.
Yep. The next one is Apache. This is the most common web server out there. Chances, if you're on a shared host, chances are they're running Apache. If you are running Apache on your VPS, know how to restart it. If something's going wrong, and you know, just learn how to restart it. Learn now rather than later, you know, if it's starting to go down. Make sure it's set to start on boot, whatever, you know, web server you're using. So, you know, we've actually ran into this problem where we tried booting and the wrong one. We actually had 2 web servers were installed. The wrong one started on boot.
And then, yeah, because of that, the second one couldn't, because it's like, hey, I want port 80, but someone else is on port 80. And there was Apache sitting there, like, serving up a big, dumb web page. It's like, oh, I'm ready.
The thing is, you know, if your host or your, you know, data center or whatever you're hosting at, their power goes out or something and your machine goes down, mm-hmm. if you're not there but the power comes up and the machine reboots automatically, you want it to be able to, you know, fire up without you being there and start running.
Boy, that sounds like a very similar situation that we've been in recently, I tell you.
Mod rewrite, it seems like, you know, URL friendlies, URLs are really important with SEO these days. So I don't really see very many sites that don't do it anymore. Mod rewriting. So learn how to do mod rewrite. Usually, if you're on a shared host, especially, you'll be doing this in htaccess, which are just special files in the folders that you want redirected. 301 redirects are really important for changing URLs for SEO reasons as well. These are the most common reasons to change your htaccess, and then basic auth if you want to set up a little username and password.
Yeah. Htaccess is like a little file that tells Apache, you know, it's like basically on a per directory configuration thing. You can like, it's like, hey, look, I have a different configuration than the big master one, so read this.
Most things on a server are dependent on accurate time. You know, anything from logs to web servers. Make sure your time is accurate. You can use the NTP protocol, which is network time protocol, to keep in sync. Just install NTPD if you're on a Linux box. I think Mac and Windows do this automatically.
By default,
nowadays.
Yeah, I think so too.
By default.
I think Linux does too by default, to be honest with you. Well, I guess like Ubuntu, I know Ubuntu server does, but who knows?
Yeah, I was actually, before the show, I checked my cell phone on my Linux computer, and it is definitely up to date. So
yeah.
Tools to automate some of your deployments and even full-on servers, you know, it'll automatically go in and install Apache and all these things in case your machine fries and you need to make a new machine, or maybe the traffic is going to your site like crazy and you need to add another server. Tools like Capistrano for Ruby Which it, you know, it's written in Ruby, but actually can Capistrano can work with PHP or
yeah,
or
I mean Python. It's meant to be a generic tool for deployment. But yeah.
Fabric is another one that can do deployment type stuff. And it's not just deployment, it can do it can install things. Puppet and Chef are more towards installing, you know, like full on configuration system with multiple machines.
Yeah, system configuration management is usually what it's called.
Basically, you write your recipe or your script one time, and that's your server, and you can just deploy it to tons of machines, and they'll automatically start installing and configuring.
Rather than keeping like a doc or a text file that says like installed this and then did this, you actually write a script or something in Puppet or Chef that is, you know, smart enough to know that when you say install this, it means actually sudo apt-get install blah blah blah. Yep. Pretty cool. Pretty high level though. I think you tend to get to that more after you're an advanced system administrator.
Another job for the system administrator is backing up and disaster recovery. Check out episode 93, a little bit more about the specifics of that. But basically, you want to back up database, the files, and the configs. Mm-hmm. Tips for getting started. You know, if you got a Mac, start running MAMP. M-A-M-P, just mm-hmm. Google it, or WAMP for Windows type people, or LAMP, you know, set up a box if you got one. You can also make a virtual machine, which is, you know, it's a good way to do it.
I really highly recommend that. I mean, it's as much as, I mean, I use OS X a little bit and stuff, but really if your server environment is going to be, you know, Linux or something, some flavor of Linux, I mean, check it out. Set up a virtual machine with it and play around with it, because really it's there's almost no substitute. I mean, MAMP and WAMP work for development, but like if you really want to prepare for your system administration, get on that system. I mean, the truth is I remember it was 6 years ago, I had never used Linux at all, and I was like, I was so afraid to. And then one day at work, you know, it was kind of a challenge between me and my coworkers. We were like, you know, we should learn Linux. And we're like, yeah, you know what we should do is we should just ditch Windows right now and just install, you know, this new distro called Ubuntu that we'd heard of that was pretty good, you know. And we kind of started, you know, giving each other the little elbow like, ah, come on, do it. And so finally we both, you know, decided to do it. We wiped Windows and we said, you know, any problems that we have is a solution that will help us learn this system even more. So, I mean, that's extreme for a lot of people, but, you know, setting up a virtual machine and just, you know, let's say like, oh, I'm going to pretend that this is my web server out on the internet that I'm running and I'm going to administer, you know, make that virtual machine, play around with it, get used to it, get familiar, and then you'll be on your way.
Yeah, it's a very limited risk situation. Really, there's no risk for a virtual machine, hardly.
Exactly. So those are some tips and tricks and links. There's going to be all kinds of links in the show notes. So check those out on basic system administration tips and tricks for web developers. That wraps it up for this episode. I want to remind you, you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. If you haven't done that yet, we highly recommend you do so. You can also leave feedback for the show using various methods by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. And also, I have a special request. If you know of someone doing web technology and you think they like to listen to podcasts, send them along a link for the show. We appreciate any help we can get from you guys for spreading the word. Thank you for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. And we will see you guys next week.